Tune it in, check it out, listen up, find out what it is all about.
Hello, this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9 Placidus, New Mexico. And as part of our series of getting to know Placidans and our near neighbors, we'll just say people who live in Bernalillo. But so for today, we are going to be speaking with someone who you probably know a lot of their accomplishments, but not perhaps everything about them. So welcome to the program, Matt DeGregory.
Good morning.
Good morning. And I guess, where shall we begin? When did you become a Placidan?
Well, probably officially in 1972 or 3. You know, my parents lived in Albuquerque in the late 40s, early 50s, and my dad couldn't make a living, so we grew up in Indiana, which is where we're all from. But my brother became a hippie, and my mother said, you've got to go to New Mexico. So my brother moved out here and was part of the hippie culture of Placidus in the early 70s. And just coming out to visit him quite often, starting from the time when I was 12 years old, you know, he originally lived in Bernalillo, fell in love with Placidus. And after a while, I decided to go to film school, so I went to UCLA in Los Angeles, and I was living in LA. And every time I'd come out to New Mexico to visit my brother, I'd go, why the heck am I leaving this place? You know, it was just so beautiful, and I was totally enthralled with the vistas and the color and the mountain and the sky and everything about it. And in 1986, my brother opened the Prairie Star restaurant, and the lease ran out at my house at the beach in Manhattan Beach, and I decided it was time maybe to make a change in life, and realized I hated Los Angeles and moved to Placidus. And
what happened
here
to
almost
your
30
film
years.
Career?
Well, now we feed film people, but there really wasn't a film industry at the time in New Mexico. So I tried thinking, you know, I'd find something here, but there just wasn't anything here. And after 6 years of working at Prairie Star, I realized I really loved the restaurant business, which was interesting because my first job at 15 was a dishwasher, and I swore I'd never work in the restaurant industry again.
Or do dishes.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, on my business card now, it says CEO and head dishwasher. So,
so you're keeping it alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in that 2 minutes and 10-second explanation, there's just so many more follow-up questions there, that why did your parents even come to Albuquerque from Indiana?
That's an interesting story. My grandmother had tuberculosis, and that was the common thing at that time. You would move to the Southwest for higher, drier climates to combat tuberculosis, so that's how my grandparents came here.
And did they get relief?
You know, I that's probably way before my time. I would assume she did. But my mother absolutely fell in love with New Mexico. And I remember coming to New Mexico from the time I was 2 years old. It was the first time I ever came here. I remember traveling here as a kid, you know, summer vacations, we always came to New Mexico. And I vividly remember things from when I was a small child. So,
giving away too much, approximately what year was that?
Oh, 63.
And I started coming out here in maybe 2001. I can't imagine what it was like 40 years before that.
Kind of the same, but very much different. You know, it was certainly more rural and rugged, I guess. It was completely different than Indiana, that's for sure. I mean, there was nothing like it. And I remember every time I'd come out here, people would go, well, can you drink the water? And do you need a visa or a passport or whatever? And, you know, it was this completely foreign place to them. So it was always neat going back to Indiana and saying, oh, man, New Mexico is this totally cool place, and, you know, all the neat things that were about it.
And as a young teenager, what was there to occupy your time?
I think, you know, my brother was very much into music and playing music, and there were groups of people that, you know, they kind of would gather around and play music. And we used to hike a bunch, you know, going up to the hot springs in the Jemez with your mother when you're 12 years old was always interesting.
Oh, yes.
you know, hiking to Tent Rocks back before anyone knew it was there, and you were the only person there, and just really seeing that kind of stuff. You know, I'd never seen a mountain before until I came to New Mexico.
That must have been totally...
I remember the very first time, and again, I was probably 6 or 7 years old when we drove out here, and I had memory of that, seeing the Sandias for the first time coming in on I-40, and was just like, oh my God, this is so cool.
A twin-engine prop plane?
Well, no, on a big family station wagon.
Oh, whoa. You got the complete view.
Yeah. So, you know, those kind of memories really hit me, and it was just always, you know, I remember when I was probably 16, 17 years old, my brother had a garage that was half buried into the hill and had a flat roof, and you could sleep up there and under the stars. Sure. And that was one of my favorite things to do, was to sleep outside and see shooting stars. And the stars are, you know, totally incredible here. So all those kind of things just really burned on my brain and said, God, this is one of the most beautiful places there is.
And it doesn't seem like it's gotten old for you.
No, most certainly hasn't. I mean, you think about, I get asked all the time, it's like, well, where would you live other than here? And it's really hard to say, I can't really think of any place. We have great weather, the people are great, the culture's great, the food's incredible. It's
not,
a great
not only
place
the prepared food, which we'll get to, but the food that consumers, shoppers like myself can do is,
right,
you're in the middle of the country, yet you get like California farm valley quality food,
right,
which has to be great for you.
Well, you know, we miss certain things, like, you know, seafood's always a challenge, although, you know, there's ways to get it fresh out of the ocean within 24 hours. You can still get that. It's just a little bit more hard. You know, we were in Houston over the weekend, and, you know, the fresh seafood there is just insane, and
sure,
nothing like that here. So we do have limitations with that, but for the most part, you know, we have green chili, which no one else has. So
that's right. Although I'm not sure if it's the same. Our most recent place of residence was on the east coast of Florida, kind of near the spaceport. And the cruise port, as well as a huge orange-producing area. Well, you couldn't get Florida oranges. They
right.
were all sent to California. We could only get California oranges, which made no sense to me. And there wasn't, like, a local dock where you could go and buy seafood. And so we were getting the same grocery store kind of seafood that we got here, only it's better here. So I never really understood why we didn't have this abundance of fresh seafood. But so your brother came out first. He was a quote-unquote hippie.
Yeah.
And how did your mother know that he should move to Placidus? Not only Albuquerque, but Placidus.
Well, you know, my mother was a very spirited soul, and she was an unusual person. And she looked for the things that were unusual in life and a little bit off the beaten path. And you know, she was never happy in Indiana. She didn't like it. You know, her heart and soul was always to move back to New Mexico, which she eventually did. And she just encouraged my brother, said, don't stay here. Don't stay in Indiana. Go to New Mexico. You'll love it there. And he ended up meeting his wife, and several of his friends from Indiana had moved out here as well. So there was kind of a home base of friendliness that, you know, he knew. And one of those friends said, you got to check out Placidus. And that's where he ended up moving.
And was 165 paved at that point?
It was paved, but it was much narrower than it was. The S-curves were much more extreme. And, you know, back in the day when he eventually built his house on Tunnel Springs Road, it took almost a year to get a telephone. And if you wanted a UPS delivery, the only place they would go was Lizzie's Mountain View Grocery in the Village. So I remember him getting things that they had ordered, like their dining room table, came from Nashville, Indiana, and it had to be sent to Lizzie's because that's the only place UPS delivered.
Was it the old Sears catalog? Were you?
No, it was a homemade, you know, someone craftsman in Nashville, Indiana made it, and it was a beautiful old oak table. And so, yeah, that was the way things happened.
I don't think we realize how much things have changed just convenience-wise.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I remember I think the first or second house I lived in the Village, you know, it was like we couldn't get TV because we were blocked, the mountain blocked any signal. And I thought, oh, God, what are we going to do? And then all of a sudden cable TV came to Placidus, and it was like, wow, this is the most amazing thing ever.
It really is. And now we don't know how amazing it is, but there's a lot of stuff out there. So what happened to your brother that he, you know, got religion and decided to get like a real job?
Well, he was always in the construction industry, and so he built several houses in the Placidus area. He was really into solar homes and right. passive solar homes, and built a beautiful passive solar home on Tunnel Springs Road. It was a very unusual house design, and that was something else that when I was a kid, it was like, wow, this is the coolest house I've ever sure. seen. So he was really into that culture and you know, built dozens of houses up here.
He never took the bend of the Taos earth ships.
No, never did. Never went that way.
Thank God.
Yeah. But, you know, I remember at 12 years old going to Dome Valley and hanging out in some of those bizarre domes that were mm-hmm. up there. And, again, that was an impression that said, wow, there's these really cool houses. And I love architecture and things like that. And there were some really unique places here. I remember that there was a commune home up there that was a dome made out of car tops. And the windows rolled down like a car door.
How interesting.
You know, so there were some really interesting things here. And to be exposed to that at 12 years old really left an impression on me. But, you know, he still is in the construction business, and his wife, Christine, was the one that kind of found the Prairie Star building and got a group of investors together to start that. So, my brother was kind of in the restaurant business by accident.
Right. Well, I guess kind of like, Abby Hoffman, you know, from the 60s, right. was a real activist, and then he became a lawyer and became part of establishment.
Right,
so
right.
You know, age will do that to you.
Exactly.
And what was the menu of the Prairie Star?
You know, Prairie Star, when it first started out, was kind of elegant comfort food, I guess would be the best way to describe it. It wasn't full-blown fine dining, but it wasn't low scale. It was really nice. And at the time, Prairie Star was just the most amazing place because it was this old house that sat out in the middle of nowhere. There was no golf course around it. It was just the house that had been converted into this restaurant. It was a really special place. I mean, it just had this aura about it that was amazing. Over time, you know, they decided to become more fine dining, and they brought in a fancy chef from California. And to me, it kind of lost its appeal, you know, because it was no longer that. And then the golf course came, and then the building got expanded, and the patios went away, and the pool went away, and right. it no longer looked like a house, you know.
But it was an existing restaurant.
No. It was a house, and it was for sale. And the Santa Ana tribe purchased it. And so it was the first business that was kind of Anglo-Native American
partnership.
Partnership, yeah, yeah. exactly. They won some awards for doing that, for being kind of the first to do that. And my brother went on to do a lot of work for Santa Ana Pueblo. He built the first three renditions of the casino and did a lot of their government buildings and some housing for them. And he's become kind of a developer type person.
How things have changed.
Yeah, yeah.
Is he still the same humble brother?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
Were you close growing up? Or?
You know, there was an age difference of 10 years. So I have two older brothers and one younger brother. And the gap is 8 to 10 years between us. And so he was more or less on the road by the time I was kind of cognizant. So he was kind of that mysterious older brother that would come and go. But yeah.
I mean, which is always great.
Yeah. I'm close to all of my brothers, fortunately. You know, we have a really good relationship. And all of us live out here except for one brother that's still in Indiana.
He hasn't figured it out.
He would be here in a heartbeat, but his wife's a Midwestern girl and likes green grass and trees. And
well, we have that. You just have to look a little harder.
Exactly,
for it.
Exactly.
So at what age did you become a permanent Albuquerque Placidus person?
Let's see. I moved here, 30 years ago I moved here. So what is that?
85?
23, I guess. 86 is when I moved here, yeah.
And, but then that was after UCLA film school.
Right.
So you graduated and came straight here.
I spent 4 years in Los Angeles. So that was pretty much, I was in school for probably three of those years and then spent a year there. You know, my job was semi-related to the film industry.
Right.
And, you know, it just literally came time for my lease came up, and it was either move closer to work because I had a 30-mile commute, and in Los Angeles, that's absolutely ridiculous. That's
a day.
You know? Yeah, it's 3 hours of travel time one way. And one of the funny things is when I said I'm going to live in Placidus, people go, oh my God, why would you ever want to live there? It's so far away. And I'm like, come on, I used to live in Los Angeles. This is nothing.
I would think people would say, where is Placidus,
yeah,
rather than why is Placidus.
Exactly, exactly.
Is there some place, could we someplace on YouTube maybe find your senior project of a film you made?
No. I still have it. It's on 8mm film, and it's probably totally would disintegrate if I tried to transfer it. But my goal in film school, I didn't want to be the director. I didn't want to be the writer. I didn't want to be the producer. I wanted to be the guy lugging cables around. You know, I wanted to be a grip. I wanted to, you know, back when I was, I think, 10 or 11 years old, I used to work in theater productions and was like the props guy.
Right.
You know, so I really enjoyed that type of stuff. And I figured the film industry would be something similar to that, where I could get some sort of work in that realm. You know, interestingly enough, my roommate in college went on to make it huge in the film business, and his name's Steven Summers, and he wrote and produced and directed The Mummy Returns, Scorpion King, Van Helsing, all those movies. So
really?
Had I stuck around, I probably would have done okay, but God, I would have still been in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and I would have hated it.
And you never had the smell of the grease paint? You never wanted to be in front of the camera?
No, it wasn't an attraction to me.
And has that carried over to your professional life as a restaurateur? That
I think to a certain respect that the restaurant business is a production, and it is kind of a play, and it's theater to a certain degree. I mean, you want to create an interesting place. You want the guest to come in and have a unique atmosphere. You know, you want to put some effort into that, which I think I do. I mean, it'd be real easy to go to Hobby Lobby and buy a bunch of, you know, garbage and vomit it all over the walls. But I tend to go and look for unusual things to fill my restaurants with to make a creative, interesting space for the guests to come. And we do that with the food as well. You know, we pride ourselves on making things from scratch. We don't open a can or a jar or a box and a mix and things like that. You know, make it the way your mother used to make it in the 50s and 60s.
You didn't eat at my house. So is that a product of the fine dining restaurant you worked in at your brother's?
To a certain degree. I mean, the chef that was there, his name was Marshall Briggs, and he was a classically trained French chef, and he was like really on top of, like, you cut the garlic this way and this way only. You don't smash it because it'll bruise it. And it was that kind of thing. But
they're like captains of ships or prison wardens.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And he was that type of guy. But taking raw food from, you know, right out of the garden or wherever to the plate, his processes were incredible, and I learned a ton from that. And my business partner in the range, Tom Fenton, worked under him as well. So, you know, when we first started talking about doing the range, I said, we have to have meatloaf on the menu. And Tom said, well, I've never made meatloaf before. And he just ended up taking Marshall's kind of classic French cooking methods and applied it to meatloaf, and we've had that same recipe now for 24 years.
And it is delightful.
Thanks.
All right, so you were working at the Prairie Star restaurant.
Right.
And how did you get your own? I mean, that must have been a difficult family conversation. I'm leaving.
Yeah, get a new dishwasher. Prairie Star was kind of going through that change of going in a direction that I didn't really think was the right thing for it, you know, because I just thought it had this really warm, homey feel to it, and it suddenly became pretentious, and it became a place where you didn't go once a week, you then went for only special occasions. And I started as a waiter there. I became a bartender. One day the pastry chef went on vacation, and I said, well, I'll fill in. Give me some. I went through my sister-in-law's recipe catalog and kind of found some desserts. And 2 weeks later, they fired him and hired me as the pastry chef. So I kind of self-taught myself.
Because baking is entirely different than cooking.
Absolutely. It's chemistry and it's science and things like that.
You can't wing it.
And I suddenly realized that, you know, I had a knack for it, and I was into finding out unique different things. So I'd take a little bit of this recipe and a little bit of that recipe, and I'd combine it with, you know, the two and add something else to create a completely new dish. And out of that, I started baking for other restaurants. So I was baking for Scalo and Cafe Oceana. And Scalo at the time was kind of the place in Albuquerque. It was the first restaurant in Albuquerque to really bring kind of modern food to town. And they were huge. That was like the big hit and everything like that. So I went to work for them and realized that they had a passion for food that kind of matched mine. And I really liked what they were doing. And eventually, you know, I was eating 2-3 times a week at Abuelita's, you know, and loved the building that Abuelita's was in. And the owner had passed away and the mother took it over. And I kind of kept saying, you know, God, this could be something so much more. There was a place that I used to eat in Manhattan Beach called the Local Yolk, and it was a big breakfast place. And I wanted to kind of take Local Yolk's idea and theme and right. put it in Bernalillo, because at the time we had two Mexican restaurants and I think we had Pizza Hut and KFC, and that was it. That was the only choices for food. And I finally said, you know, I'm going to go in one day and ask Lucy, who was the owner at the time, what's going to happen, because I heard she was moving out of that building. So I was on my way to Prairie Star and I decided I needed gas. I'm going to take a left down Main Street and go fill up at Frank's Conoco. And I'm sitting there staring at the building across the street. And I said, okay, this weekend I'm going to go in, I'm going to ask Lucy. And I walked in to pay for my gas, and there's a sign on the door. It said Abuelita's Restaurant, for rent see Frank inside. I literally pulled the sign off the door and walked in and said, Frank, how much? And he said $500 a month. I said, I'll take it.
And that is kind of typical small town USA, where the gas station has the for sale or for lease sign right. for the restaurant next door.
He also happened to be the landlord for it. So, you know, and when he said $500 a month, I thought, well, this is doable, you know. And I thought, well, the building must be in good shape. I wasn't able to see the inside of the kitchen or anything like that. But I walked into Prairie Star that day and Tom Fenton was on the line. And I was talking to my friend Catherine and I said, you know, I'm going to open my own restaurant. I've got this great location. The only problem is I don't have any money. And Tom kind of peeked around the corner and said, I can get some money. And I said, well, do you want to be my partner? And that's how the range started. And we started and for $17,000, you know.
And you leased it sight unseen, other than right, visiting it as
right,
a customer.
Right. I had never been back in the kitchen. And, though, you know, we thought we'd get in there on August 1st and we'd open within, you know, 2 weeks. Well, of course, when we found out the condition of the kitchen, it was a month later. And, you know,
that's quite not
a
too bit, bad.
Not too bad, but, you know, when you're working on a shoestring and you barely have any money, it's forever. So, right. you know, we opened up that first day on September 2nd, 1992, and we were so busy we ran out of food and couldn't open for dinner.
Jeez.
So it was kind of right place, right time, instant hit, and we were really lucky.
And we're talking about the range.
Correct.
And the menu is unique.
It is.
Had you been thinking for a long period of time? I mean, how did you decide? I mean, it's like writing a book.
Right.
How did you come up with the menu, or you and Tom?
You know, a lot of it was ideas that I'd been, you know, I'd been thinking about my own restaurant for probably a year. And, you know, I kept thinking about going in and talking to Lucy. And then, like I said, the rumor was that she was moving. So I started kind of imagining what that menu was in my mind, and I knew we had to have some New Mexican style food, but because that's all that was available, we needed to have something else.
Sure.
So I knew we wanted to have a really killer breakfast menu. We wanted to have really great pastry, and Tom brought in the element of the kind of the dinner part. You know, the breakfast lunch was kind of all my ideas. Dinner was kind of on him. And eventually, over time, it just morphed into what it was. And I think it's what people were looking for. You know, there were Placidus at the time was kind of in the beginning of an explosion. You know, all of a sudden, developments were happening. And it wasn't a place that just the hippies lived, that why in God's earth would you want to live up there? So suddenly people were discovering it. And I was like, I knew Placidus was going to be the big draw. And at the same time, Bernalillo was kind of turning into a cool place. There were artists that were sort of moving in. And I saw this wave of creativity and just thought, you know, we need to have a creative food space as well.
Right. And I should remind everyone, if you have just tuned in or recently tuned in, this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM in Placidus, New Mexico, and we are speaking with Matt DeGregory, not the least of which is partners with Tom in the Range and Ranges, and most recently in the town of Bernalillo, the Freight House. All right, so back to the first range.
Sure.
Actually, maybe the first. I'm more familiar with the second down in Bernalillo. How did you pick out all of these items? Where did you go? Were you the original picker?
Items as far as food,
or like the cow in the phone booth.
The art is kind of an interesting story, because when we first opened, we had nothing on the walls. I mean, my mother came in and kind of decorated the first range, and she was good at finding weird, unique things and turning them into other things. Kind of drove my dad insane a little bit, because she'd bring these things home. My dad, well, what are you going to do with that? And the next thing you know, it'd be this beautiful table or something.
Wow.
And Sally Hall, this artist in Placidus, kind of showed up the day before we opened and said, you need some art on your walls. Can I bring you something? And I said, sure. So we hung her art, and we finally decided that, well, let's be a place for artists to hang work. And we weren't going to charge anything if they sold it. All the money would go to the artist. And then we had our fire, and after the fire, a group of people organized kind of a fundraiser to help rebuild the restaurant.
And this was the downtown range.
This was the original location.
And what year was that?
95.
Okay.
We had just finished remodeling the building, and 2 weeks later it was gone. But a number of artists donated artwork for an art auction, and because of that, we've always supported local art. And, you know, Placidus has tons of really great artists, Evans is one of them. And Roger brought us we still have the first piece. It's the Ron Bell piece that you'll see in the range. It's a billboard with Ron Bell kind of behind a Coors Light ad. And that piece got damaged in the fire, and he took it out and brought it back to us as a gift, all restored. So Roger has been a fabric of the range ever since, you know, and Roger's one of the people that I can just say, Roger, I need something over here, and he'll come up with something so bizarre and creative that it just fits. And he kept eyeing the phone booth and said, it needs a cow in there.
That's exactly what I thought. It needed a cow.
Yeah.
A cow in the phone booth. Do you know where the cow was found or sourced? Because we didn't have internet and stuff back then. It must have been harder to find things.
Well, Roger Evans made that cow.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's made, you know, at our two Albuquerque locations, if you've not been there, they're worth going to just to see Roger Evans' murals that he's created. At our Manal store, it's about probably 60 foot long and has coyotes flying out of it and across the ceiling on balloons. And when we came up with the Wyoming store, it had a much bigger canvas for him to work on. So it's probably about 100 feet long. And we've got cows flying off that on with helicopter packs on their back. And
an unusual fellow.
Yeah. And there's a cow sitting at the counter eating hay and a salt lick. And when the phone booth actually was a functioning phone booth that's been in that building since it was a drugstore in the 60s. And when they took the payphone out finally, the phone booth was sitting there, and Roger said, well, how about we put a cow in there, and that cow can be calling the cow that's at the Wyoming store. So,
and how many of your patrons know that the cow is calling the other cow?
Hardly anybody. Right? I mean, you'd have to be pretty sharp to figure that out. You know, there's really nothing that says that, but it's our own backstory, I
sure.
guess. After the cow in the phone booth, we realized, well, Bernalillo doesn't have a big mural like the other two Albuquerque stores do. So that's how the cows came out on the front of the store.
Sure. Well, and it makes it easy to tell people where to meet you.
Right. So right.
How long had you been operating the Range 1 before you said, you know, this is not enough craziness in my life.
Right.
I really need to make my things worse. Let's open another restaurant.
Well, you know, obviously we were bursting at the seams with the range. And when the fire happened, we moved to the convent as a temporary spot. Marianne Bessem at the time used to have a flower shop in Bernalillo and had that as an event space. It wasn't being used all the time, but it had a kitchen. She said, you can move in here as a temporary spot. Eventually, we landed where we are now in Rose's Center. And that has just continued to be busier and busier every year for the last 20 plus years. And there was a point in time where I started looking with another group of people at the spot next to Jackalope on the river as another location for a different kind of restaurant. And we tried to get off that off the ground, but it didn't happen. But in that conversation with one of the investors in that, he had a restaurant in Albuquerque. and it wasn't doing very well. And I kept walking to this restaurant going, we should turn this into a range. And that's what happened. So at Wyoming and Montgomery, I think it was about year 2000 when right. we opened up that location. And it was an instant hit as well, because the people of Albuquerque were like, you know, Bernalillo's gotten too busy. We don't go there anymore because the crowds are so much.
We don't Bernalillo too busy. I have exactly. to chuckle at that.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny. So we had a place there, kind of took some of the pressure off of the range in Bernalillo. And then a few years later, we found the Manal store and said, well, let's go again. And that was an instant success. So the range has been kind of a really easy one to pull off. Every time we open, it just seems to work, you know. And I think it's because we create a unique appetizing right. experience for people.
And so what happened to say, I'm going to open up a restaurant about a mile away to compete with my other restaurant?
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. You know, the Freight House Kitchen and Tap came about, probably it started about 18 years ago when I discovered this building in downtown Albuquerque called the Santa Fe Freight House. It's on the historic register. It's part of the Santa Fe Railroad from the heyday in the 30s and 40s with Fred Harvey and the Alvarado Hotel and all that kind of stuff. And it was this beautiful building. And I was like, my God, this would make such a killer restaurant. And there was no information about it. I spent a year trying to find out how I could get access sure. to it, and finally found someone. And I was able to go inside the building and found out that because it's on the historic register, you can't alter it. And it's the old offices of the Santa Fe Railroad. That's so cool. It's all these little cubicles
right.
that you can't touch. So the feasibility of a restaurant was impossible. On top of that, they ended up putting the Greyhound bus station across the street and the transportation center and ruined any chance of it ever being a restaurant.
Right.
But that idea kind of has stuck with me forever. I've always wanted to do the Freight House. So when the Flying Star went out of business, the owners of the property called me up and said, you know, we would like
to
talk to
you. For you.
Well, it wasn't really that. It was kind of like, would you come and look at this space and let us know what you think should go in here? They weren't really soliciting me to look at it.
They needed a consultation.
They were wanting to consult with me. They said, we're not pushing you to rent this, but we would like your input on it. And the more I started going in there, realizing it's a killer building. It's really a tremendously nice building. And the fact that it's on the railroad tracks, it's walking distance mm-hmm. from the rail runner, and had this sort of industrial feel to it.
Has a current up-to-date kitchen.
Oh, the kitchen's like phenomenal. Right. I mean, it's like the most impressive kitchen you've
not
ever
like
seen.
Like Lucy's.
Right, exactly. You know, we basically didn't have to touch the kitchen. And it was almost fully equipped, and it was basically just a makeover. And the more I started talking with our team, our executive chef and our operations guy, this kind of turned into the menu that we have today. And we hired a great company called Modulus Design that did the design build of the bar area. And they really brought in the train feel without being gimmicky. You know, right. it'd be easy to go and have a model train running around on a track
sure.
and, you know, a bunch of railroad signs
like
and stuff like that. You know, that's typical. And there's other restaurants called Freight House across the country, and they all do that. But we decided we wanted to do something a little bit different.
Kind of like a Christmas cottage. They're
exactly. You know, and I just didn't, you know, it goes back to my thing about going to Hobby Lobby and buying a bunch of train stuff and right. throwing it up on the walls.
Yeah. But we were in there recently, you know, to check it all out. And I was looking around trying to see remnants of Flying Star. And it was very hard to find it.
We've pretty much gone over the entire space.
Right. Just the whole layout is different. The fact that you turned the ordering counter into a real bar with large screen TVs.
Right.
It's a nice place. It's more of that brew pub where you come in, have a brew or probably one right. or two and watch something. It doesn't have to be a table of four for dinner.
Right. Well, you know, we still don't have our furniture in yet, so we have a very long community table that seats about 30 people. We don't have the stools in yet. They should be in next week. Right now we're using our patio furniture for the table or for the chairs. But, you know, we've got board games and stuff like that, and we want to try and create a place where people can come and hang out and enjoy some good food, or, you know, even they want to just come hang out and play chess or checkers or whatever.
Right.
We're trying to create that comfortable atmosphere.
But with a fantastic variety of beer at, I would say, and don't act on this, but below market restaurant prices for beer.
Well, you know, we hopefully bought right and try and make it affordable. I mean, you know, I'm really against gouging people for things, and try and make things as affordable as we possibly can while still maintaining our quality levels. And right. You know, that's the one thing people say, oh, you're expensive. It's like, well, you know, yeah, I could buy it that burger frozen mm-hmm. and preformed and probably loaded with some chemicals for about half the price of what we get the fresh beef for. But I refuse to do that. You know, we try and provide it as inexpensive as we can. But the way we do things, it's a little bit more expensive than the average corporate chain restaurant. So,
but as you said, it's an entirely different dining experience from a quality. I mean, it's not what I would call hoity-toity or whatever. It's just good quality food served in a comfortable atmosphere, like all the
which
ranges.
Yeah, which is, that's kind of our theme. You know, even with Standard Diner that we have downtown, we've tried to be unique and different, but maintaining a level of commonness, I guess, so that people aren't intimidated by it when they walk in the door and it's not so frou-frou that they don't understand a terminology or something.
Yeah.
It just makes for comfort.
Well, before this conversation turns into a mini-series, I'd like to get a little bit more into Matt DeGregory. Let's start with, I mean, you now have how many locations at your...
We have 5 restaurants. We're working on number 6 with Rio Grande and I-40 for the range.
5 wasn't enough, and you just opened
exactly.
One. Yeah. Okay. So you have a partner. So what's the hierarchy? Who gets to make the final decision?
Well, it's probably Tom more or less is retired at this point. He kind of hangs out and does the music end of it, which is kind of, you know, his background was, you know, mine was film, his was music. Played in the Last Mile Ramblers, which was a popular band in the 70s around New Mexico. So he's kind of come back to being that, and he's kind of taking it easy at this point, and I'm taking the bull by the horns and trying to create a big business out of it.
But there are investors also, but silent partners.
No, not really. No. You know, the all the ranges are owned by me and Tom. Freight House is owned by me and Tom, and Standard Diner I have with my 2 brothers.
So it is a family business, which is great. They didn't want to get involved with the range, or you didn't?
You know, it wasn't a possibility. You know, 24 years ago, it was a different scenario. Oh,
that's true. Obviously, you can't be in 5 restaurants at once. So how does your day go? Do you, you know, go in and check the receipts every day, or inspect the kitchens?
You know, the main thing is we have really incredible people working for us. Our operations manager has been in the restaurant business forever. Our CFO has been in the business, you know, since the Last Supper. Ann, our manager, general manager of the range, is also the general manager of Freight House. She's just been here forever. You know, I worked with her at Cafe Oceana and Prairie Star years ago. So we just have this really amazing team. I've got a great chef, executive chef. I've got a great chef at Freight House, and people stick with us. You know, we've got Andrea, one of our servers at Bernalillo, has been with us since she was 16 years old in 1993.
Wow,
you know, still working for us, and we have a lot of people that hang out with us for
a long time. Everybody seems very happy, which usually restaurants aren't conducive to people being happy.
Well, I think it's you know, learning to treat your employees as best you can, treat them as human beings and with respect. You know, we started a thing about 4 or 5 years ago where we wanted to change the culture of our business and turn it into something where the employee has kind of skin in the game.
Okay.
If they have an idea of something that's better, we want to hear it. And if it kind of fits the bill, then we make that change. And we encourage our employees to participate in the betterment of our restaurant and the betterment of the experience for our guests. And, you know, some of the best ideas have come from, like, the dishwasher, you know.
They see everything.
They definitely see everything. You know, it's one of the most important positions in the place. So we're very open-minded, and we aren't crazy anal about certain things, and, sure. and it just seems to work. And we focus on hiring really good people as well.
And that's wonderful that you provide so many jobs for local people, and they don't have to go to a mega chain or
right.
You know, or Frankenburger kind of place.
Well, I think that's a very important thing, because, you know, people say, oh, you just want to do this for the money. I've never opened a restaurant for money. You know, I do it because I truly love to serve people. I truly love to hire people. I love the fact that we employ 350 people in our company and that we're growing that. The end result is I make money, yes, mm-hmm. and that's a wonderful thing, but it's not my sole focus. You know, yeah. I really, really love when I set a plate of food in front of someone and they enjoy it and go, wow, that was amazing. That, to me, is all the money I need.
Do I smell IPO?
God, who knows, maybe someday. But, you know, the range concept is probably the one to have the most legs and move forward with that. You know, my little brother in Indianapolis is begging me to come to a place in Indianapolis, and we found a location, and I'm going, oh, God, let's do it, you know. But that's going to be a really hard thing to pull off. But, you know, like I said, we've been concentrating on building the core of our business so that it works really, really well.
Is there a... I don't want to say a national chain, but maybe a restaurant with 30 or 40 locations that you're thinking now of possibly modeling yourself after?
Oh, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because
that's my job.
There's probably three different restaurant groups that I've studied and keep my eyes on. One is the main one, the one that kind of started me down the path of realizing there's a better chain restaurant. Is Let Us Entertain You out of Chicago, Richard Melman. I don't know if you'd know any of his restaurants,
but
lettuce is spelled like the vegetable. But they have probably 50 or 60 different concepts and well over 100 restaurants. And you go into any of them, and it doesn't feel like a chain restaurant. The second one I discovered was Fox Restaurant Group out of Tucson and Phoenix area. They have probably 10 different concepts and 40 or 50 restaurants. And again, you walk into any of them and they don't feel like a chain restaurant. But the last one, the most important one, is Danny Meyer of Union Square out of New York City, is probably the most phenomenal restaurateur I've ever seen, and I've been to hear him speak. I've read his book. I've been to his restaurants, and it's the best restaurant experience you could possibly have is at a Danny Meyer restaurant.
And he's in Manhattan.
He's in Manhattan. Yeah, Union Square, Gramercy Tavern, Blue Smoke, Shake Shack. You know, all these great, just killer restaurants.
That's good to know.
And it's all about hospitality. You know, they're all focused on the guest experience. It's not trying to get the customer to buy, you know, my experience at one chain restaurant. You got to get the chicken mezzaluna because it's one right. they make the most money on. You know, it's not about
or you
that.
You got to stuff the baked potato.
Exactly. You know, or the bloomin' onion. You know, it's not that kind of garbage food. They go out of their way to hire really incredible people. Their atmospheres are amazing. The service is top notch, and it's from the person who answers the phone at the reservation desk. You know, it's just a delightful experience.
So it can be done. You can run a business, be successful, be good to your employees, and have longevity.
Absolutely.
So before I get to this last question, have any, you know, there are all this reality TV.
Right.
You know, Hotel Impossible, Restaurant Impossible, Bar Rescue, all those. Have any of them ever approached you to...
We were, you know, Standard Diner was on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, yes. which actually saved that restaurant. You know, Standard Diner, the concept came about from me traveling a bunch and seeing kind of these urban diners, you know, the Fog City Diner in San Francisco, Trulux in Dallas, the Odeon Cafeteria in New York City, Buckhead in Atlanta, where all these like finer diner kind of things. And we found this great building in downtown Albuquerque. And I said, yeah, we need to do this kind of urban diner concept.
Sure.
Well, Albuquerque didn't get it. You know, they saw the word diner and thought, has to be a greasy spoon. And when they walked in and it wasn't greasy spoon, it was kind of elevated diner food, they were kind of like, we don't know about this. This is kind of iffy. So we struggled for a couple years, and then Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives came through Albuquerque. They were doing a bit on Route 66, and I think it was the Frontier they were supposed to do, and the Frontier backed out. So they were like, well, we need another diner. And they started asking around. People said, go to Standard. So they came in and did an episode on it, and next thing you know, people were like, oh God, have you been to the Standard Diner? You know, it's really great. And I kept telling my brothers, I said, we just need someone to come in here and say it's good,
right.
You know? And that's all it did took to change that kind of scariness of what it was.
Well, that Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, that's how we kind of established our core of restaurants to go to when we first came out here, was we went to all of the Triple D restaurants, and some were really good and some were, what happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, that was 8 years ago, and we still get people that come in because of that show.
Right.
On a daily basis. You know, they follow that show. So,
it's a great show.
There's people that say he's not authentic and all that kind of stuff, but he saved us. And you know,
it's a TV show.
Yeah, it's a TV show.
I mean, you know.
I wish I had his job.
Oh, how fun would that be? Well, see, then you'd have to be in front of the camera.
Yeah.
But you'd get a cool Camaro.
There you go. He doesn't actually drive the Camaro, by the way.
I would think that they ship it from city to city.
Yeah, it's trucked in, and he drives it into the parking lot. So.
Yeah. Oh, you ruined it all for me. Next, you'll be telling me that he's really a blonde.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. Well, let's wrap this up. 10 years from now, where will Matt DeGregory be? Probably living in Casa Montañas.
Well, yeah, let's hope so. You know, I think New Mexico will always be home. My goal would be absolutely to open up restaurants in other places outside of New Mexico. You know, I would love the opportunities for my employees to grow and become, you know, move up the ladder. If I can provide that for them, would be really great. And yeah, it's certainly expanding outside of my local area.
You don't think
area.
You'll get to the point of, okay, I did it. Got enough coin in the bank, I'm ready to just become a professional scuba diver or something.
Yeah, I think, you know, I set a goal of, first I said 55, and that was, you know, 10 years ago. Now it's 60, but so when I hit 60, it'll probably be 65. I certainly would love to have created a legacy where it's still working and still happening, and mm-hmm. I can go in and kiss babies and shake hands and stuff like that.
Sure.
And, really enjoy it and let someone else be running it and making the big bucks on it.
And I just thought of a follow-up question here before we wrap up. Probably tied to the fact that you didn't want to be in front of the camera when you were in film school. You wanted to be the guy lugging cables, which I don't know why, but, you know, five restaurants going on six, and if we went any place in this area and asked 50 people, who's Matt DeGregory? How many people would have any idea?
You know, I guess I do have a bit of there is some fame involved because, you know, no matter where I go, people recognize me, you know, and say, aren't you the range guy, you know?
See, I thought you were more of a behind-the-scenes guy.
Well, yeah, I guess I am behind the scenes, but, you know, people do know the range, and they know who I am. And so, yeah, I think there are people that know who I am, I suppose. Okay.
And
that could be good or bad, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you don't want people calling you up going, I had the worst apple pie ever. Well, fantastic. This has been an extended conversation, and I appreciate taking your time, especially with this this Uber restaurant chain you're running here. I wouldn't even call it a chain. It's an enterprise. But this has been a great time and a great way to kick off our Placidan series on KUPR, and this has been Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 on the FM dial in Placidas, New Mexico, and we're speaking with Matt DeGregory of restaurant fame. So thank you so much.
Thank you.